Hello, and welcome to this brand new podcast series brought to you by The Open UK. I'm your host, Matt Yakovit. I hope you'll join myself and Open UK CEO Amanda Brock as we celebrate the launch of the brand new book, Open Source Law, Policy, and Practice. Amanda was the editor of the book and brought together 24 experts in the open source software, hardware, and data space to share best practices, procedures, and laws. This book is being published by the Oxford University Press and is graciously being offered for free via non-commercial open access from the Beach Foundation. To buy or download a copy of the book, visit amandabrock.com/books for more information. We hope you'll join us as we bring in a new author every week to get key points, ideas, and advice from their specific chapters. We hope you are as excited for this series as we are, and we hope you'll like, subscribe, and share this podcast with your friends. Enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our next episode of the Open Source Law, Policy, and Practice podcast, where we are going to go through all of the authors in the book and talk about their chapters and all of the interesting things in the open source space. Once again, I'm joined by the editor of the book, Amanda Brock. Amanda, here we are at All Things Open.
Here we are indeed, and we're almost over. Like really, really almost over. This is the very last thing I'm doing before I leave.
Yes, but... we save the best for last.
Absolutely.
Yes, today we're joined by Karen Sandler. Karen, how are you doing today?
Hi, I'm great.
Ah, wonderful. Glad to hear it. Maybe give us a little introduction to you.
Yeah, I would love to. So I sometimes refer to myself as a cyborg lawyer because the reason why I'm super passionate about free and open source software is that I have a heart condition. I have a very thick heart. It's totally fine. Matt looks really worried right now. I'm not going to keel over right here, right now.
Please don't.
I have a pacemaker defibrillator that basically kicks in if I get into a dangerous situation, and I can't see the source code in my own body. And living with that defibrillator made me realize that that our software may not be made for us. And my example of that is that when I was pregnant, my heart did what normal pregnant women's hearts do. About a third of all women have palpitations when they're pregnant. For me, I had a defibrillator, so I thought I was in a dangerous rhythm, and it shocked me even though I didn't need treatment repeatedly. And the only way to stop it was to take drugs in order to slow my heart rate down. And it stood for the proposition of like, you know, this is a metaphor for a software we rely on and how it fails. Nobody in the world wants pregnant people to get shocked. Like the medical device manufacturers don't want it. The pregnant people don't want it, right? Doctors don't want it, but it's not a common use case because only 15% of defibrillators go to people under the age of 65. So it's sort of like I was an edge case and it's just, you know, and there was nothing I could do. I felt very helpless. And it, you know, it's not just defibrillators. It's all of the software we rely on that, you know, it may not be that your heart is going to be unnecessarily shocked, but it could be anything else about your privacy, your data, all the things that you rely on in your everyday life. And so because of that, I run the Software Freedom Conservancy, which is a charitable organization in the United States. And we do three main things. We stand up for copyleft licensing and advocate for free and open source software. Copyleft is this amazing lever that we have. And there's another chapter in the book that explains all of the licensing stuff. So I won't delve too deeply into it, but it's a lever we have where we can take control of our software and make sure that we can, you know, handle problems when they arise and make sure our software is in fact made for us. And so to that end, our software won't be made for us unless it is made by all of us. And so we run Outreachy, which is a diversity initiative where we do paid remote internships to people subject to systemic bias and who are impacted by underrepresentation in tech. We do about 130 internships per year, and we're putting interns with mentors in open source communities across the board, really important ones like the Linux kernel and Debian and Wikimedia. And then the last thing we do is that we'll never be able to have reliable software if we don't have alternatives to proprietary software. And so we also are the home to many free and open source software projects like Git and Inkscape and really wonderful software programs that everyone should use.
And you actually wrote the chapter on foundations, which is apropos based on your background.
Yeah. Well, I'm an engineer turned lawyer turned executive director. And so I've been involved with quite a few foundations. And I am, I admit I am a nonprofit nerd.
Hmm. And so what are we going to learn about in the chapter?
So you'll get an overview of what the foundations are in the free and open source software space, what the major forms of organizations are, and what are the major issues are that cause you to think about foundations, issues around governance and things that you need to think about. We get into some specificity about like what's happened in the United States, for example, with the Internal Revenue Service and how people think about these foundations and the way that how the money comes in and how you decide to make decisions as a community makes a big difference in terms of the way that work gets done and the way you collaborate together.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting because so many of the packages, the software that we rely on today are, you know, really sponsored and handled by foundations now. Right. You know, you mentioned some of the ones that you I've worked with. Right now, I work at a company that does, you know, very active in the Apache Foundation. Right. So most of the software that is in the open source space that we probably rely on a day to day basis is either really impacted by foundations or has a direct line to foundations.
I think that's true because foundations are super handy. They help projects take care of all kinds of things that they need to if they're going to be serious, if they're going to like do a good job at what they're doing. If they're going to take in donations and use that money for important things like hiring developers or even just supporting the community, having conferences like where, as you can probably hear some background in this podcast, because no microphone is that good. You know, like having conferences where people can really exchange ideas are essential to the success of free and open source software projects. So like anything, or even just signing contracts, things about trademarks, all the other things that are mentioned in all of the other chapters of the book are all impacted by the foundations that these projects use to embody their legal representation.
And we talked about that a bit yesterday with Pam when we were talking about trademarks and somebody having to own the trademark, somebody having to be an entity, you know, create a company or a corporation. And of course, in many cases, you don't do either. You hand the project over to a foundation to be your custodian and to look after it for you. But one of the things that I always think when anybody says foundation, and forgive me, is please don't set up another one. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people talk about, you know, oh, I've got a project, it's doing well, I'm now going to go off and build my own foundation. And I just don't think there's a need for more. What do you think?
Oh, I'll give you such a lawyerly answer. How many times have other authors said it depends on this
podcast
already?
Oh, come on, don't do that.
No, I'm just being silly. I mean, it does depend, of course. But I agree with you in principle, which is to say that I agree with you that there are many good foundations, and many of them are fiscal sponsors or umbrella organizations, and they help you get started up quickly without having to create a new organization. And many of them, like there are so many of them already that they each are like establish a particular niche. And so each of them does a different thing. And therefore, you can look at the suite of foundations that are already available and you can go to different ones. Software Freedom Conservancy, which I run, is not only a 501c3 charity, 501c3 being the section of the IRS code where it specifies the kind of what the different nonprofits are fundamentally, and it like has a different rules that govern it. And of course, charitable organizations have like really specific rules they need to follow to make sure that they're doing things in the public good. And it has advantages like 501c3s can be, if someone in the United States donates to a 501c3 organization, then they can take a tax deductible donation for it.
I think that's really important. You know, it's a problem we have even with Open UK. We're a company limited by guarantee in the UK, and we don't have that foundational structure and those tax benefits and breaks. And I think it's not just that, well, I know it's not just the UK, it's both the UK and Europe. It's really problematic for us because we don't have that culture of donating to foundations, and it's hard to raise money because of it for not-for-profits.
And so organizations that have a hard time raising from individuals for a variety of reasons often go with the 501c6 type of organization, which are organizations that are generally organized around a common business interest, often called trade associations, and they can take corporate sponsorship. And so they have they're more like a consortium model where companies can often have board seats and they can do that. Now, within each type of organization, category of organizations, there are different organizations in free and open source software that do different things. So for example, as I was saying, Software Freedom Conservancy, we are a comprehensive fiscal sponsor. And that means that our member projects, so the communities that join us, are a part of our organization. They are like analogous to a division in a corporation, as opposed to another example of another slightly different organization, which is also a 501c3, is the Software in the Public Interest. And they are more like a grant-making organization. And so a community that joins Software in the Public Interest can actually affiliate with multiple organizations. Whereas with Software Freedom Conservancy, our member projects' problems are our problems. They're a part of us. And then within the C3 space, there are different models. Like some organizations do like a series model where they just spin up lots of new organizations that are independent using the same models. So I agree with you that I think if you're looking to bring a foundation to a free and open source software project, definitely check out the umbrella organizations that are already there. Open Collective is the most lightweight because you can just sign up with Open Collective and take money, but they are not going to help you with your governance or deep dive into that like decision-making process and community management. But they're an excellent choice if you just want to get started.
So one of the things that I've seen a few times, not a lot, but I've noticed this in a couple spaces. I won't give concrete examples right now, but there are times when companies want to focus on the commercial aspects of, you know, the software that they've developed in the open source space, but they still want to have the appearance of having some of those open source roots, even if they're moving it away. So they'll create this foundation on its side on their own, you know, the X Foundation, to try and drive that, oh, look, we'll have this, but it's still really controlled by the corporate entity. I know what you'd call it, but it seems at times a bit disingenuous, because it's a way to kind of like, see, we're still really open, you know, and we still got this other arm, you should go to them. But it ends up being really ultimately controlled by that originating organization. Is that something that you've experienced before?
Oh, it's so common. And it's much more common in the C6 trade association space than it is in the charitable space. But it comes up over and over and over again. And the answer is always, as they say, follow the money, right? Who's funding it? Who makes the decisions? What are the, you know, there's a lot, especially for US organizations, there's a lot of information available. So you can get super nerdy and look on the IRS website and pull off 990s for trade associations and charities, find out salaries and who's contributing. You know, you can't necessarily find out exactly how much is coming from each donor, but you can see like the general spread of income and also what they're spending their money on. It's totally fascinating. And I just want to get back. I know, I love it so much.
So that's what you do of a Saturday night. You get some 990s and cozy up in front of the fire.
Is it embarrassing to mention that I actually do that?
Yeah, it is very embarrassing.
It's so fun. Yeah. So fun.
Well, it's a very niche hobby.
So I just wanted to like get back to something that you said before about like whether you ever need to form your own organization. And I have a good example that we just announced yesterday, which is that one of Software Freedom Conservancy's member projects, the Godot Game Engine, which is this awesome way that you can make games. They're really just taking off and a fantastic project. They came into Software Freedom Conservancy in 2015 and they've been growing ever since.
Yep.
And so now they take in about, you know, $500,000 and we've got a whole staff that works on it. And it's at the time where, you know what? They do need their own organization.
Yeah. But that's
and we help them do that.
Right?
And it's fantastic. But they did it with a fiscal sponsor. So
exactly.
We help them. They're taking all of our policies. Yeah. And we're going to be an official advisor to them.
And a lot of people do it. It's like creating a new license. It's a vanity project. So it's, you know, I have this project. I'm going to build a foundation. Rather than sit down and think, do I really need this foundation? What am I creating? It's going to have an overhead. There's a lot of work involved. There's a lot of advice needed. And you can really spend a lot of money that you don't need to. But it's like everything that the lawyer podcast. It depends. But generally, I would push back on anyone saying they need a foundation and try and dissuade them.
Well, so, okay, let's play a little armchair quarterback, I guess, or let me play role play here. Let's say I have an open source project that I started and I think it's valuable to, you know, potentially put into a foundation. So I have, you know, the podcast we're doing, we're going to do a Yonkcast. And so I'm going to donate my Yonkcast to the open source space. What are the benefits?
Very generous of you.
Very generous. What kind of benefits am I going to get? What does that process look like? you know, as you start to try to explore that?
Yeah, I mean, when you join an organization, as I said, it sort of like each organization provides different services and different help for projects. If you were to join a comprehensive fiscal sponsor, the good thing is that you could take in donations for the young cast. You could,
this is a bit worrying. I think he's going to do it.
I registered the domain yesterday.
Yeah.
I think it's a good idea. I mean, Sovereign Freedom Conservancy.
Sold.
We're really limited our fiscal sponsorship to projects that we think we can really partner with to forward software freedom. And so we would be asking you, like, is your, you know, what are you going to cover in your podcast? You're going to shed light on important issues in software freedom. And each of the different organizations will ask you different things. For us, one of the things we bring to the table is that we can really help you refine what you're doing so that you accomplish the goals. And what we find a lot of the time is that when projects are coming into Software Freedom Conservancy, that we like the whole governance questions are things that people have not thought about closely. Yeah. And the foundation sounds like it's just a legal thing you have to check the box on in order to receive money. But that conversation is so much more significant, and it really dictates, like, how will things get done? Will companies be able to have a particular sway over what happens? And is that going to be okay? Is that going to accomplish the goals of the project? If there is a company that is very involved in the project, do you want that long term? And if you do, well, then you're not a good fit for Software Freedom Conservancy, but you might be a good fit for another organization. But then how do you make that plain, and how do you like bring like an authentic and honest kind of collaboration around that? And if you don't, well, how can you put that company's feet to the fire and establish collaboration in a way that will make a vibrant ecosystem down the road?
Yeah, I mean, and that's a really good point. You know, I think that a lot of, and it gets back to what I was saying earlier around, you know, the donations from a certain organization sometimes come because they want to still view that they're doing something in the open source space. And I think it's a similar thing where they try to buy or politic their way into the influence from some of these organizations. I know from my own experience working with a lot of diverse ecosystems, there's a lot of companies out there who pride themselves on saying that, you know, 7 out of 10 board members, you know, or 7 out of 10 on the governing board are part of our organization and they work for us, and they'll actively go out, recruit, throw big dollars at these folks just to have that sway and be able to have some sort of like, you know, impact on the direction. And it's a weird thing because even though it's in the open space, it might not necessarily be for the good of everybody.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the reasons why are the C3 organizations, the charitable style organizations, do a much better job, in that they provide the construct that allows the contributors to push back and to put the interests of the community ahead of the corporate interests. Corporate interests are critical to the success of a free and open source software project. There's no doubt about it. Like, corporate stakeholders, their interests should be listened to, but at the end of the day, their interests must be seen in the context, like the entire fabric of the community and what it's trying to accomplish. And I think that is done a lot more effectively in the C3 space, it can be done effectively in the C6 space as well. But in the C3 space, each person is participating on behalf of themselves as an individual, and they have to put that corporate interest aside. It doesn't always work out that way, because there aren't, like, people think, like, just in the same way people think that the GPL is magic pixie dust, and if you license your code under copyleft, that it will automatically be complied with and that there will be sharing. And that's one of the reasons why we at SFC bring consumer rights or lawsuits and try to enforce the GPL. But it doesn't work that way. In the same way with foundations, there aren't like commissions from various governmental entities that are investigating. And what we have is, back to 990s, we have people like you, listeners, who read the information and will ask questions and be critical. And that's where these forms really are meaningful, in that they bring some transparency. And so, you know, I want to say that all the C3 organizations are great and they keep corporate interests at bay. They don't, but some of them do. And they do that by providing like a really great governance structure that provides mechanisms for corporations to participate without control.
Mm. You know, so what's a typical governance structure look like for, you know, one of the projects that you're working with?
Yeah, and I talk about this somewhat in the chapter as well. So with the projects that work with SFC, most of them have a what we call a project leadership committee.
Okay.
So it's a group of people who are elected or appointed by the community, certainly empowered by the community to make decisions on behalf of that project. And they run the gamut within SFC alone. So some of those committees are self-appointed, meaning that there are a few trusted developers or contributors who start out on a committee, and they make sure that the committee continues to represent the people who are trusted, and they do that by bringing transparency. Some of those committees are elected, and so there are different like rules for who can vote. With all of the projects within Software Freedom Conservancy, they all must have a minimum number of people, and they, you know, and we have to be satisfied that they actually represent the community that they represent, they're supposed to represent.
And is there any rotation? So is it like, you know, you can only serve so long?
So within SFC that varies, but also within foundations generally, these are the like overall models. There are self-appointed boards of directors, and then there are elected boards of directors. And each of these models comes with their own risks, their upsides and downsides to every single model. And so some organizations like OSI, which Amanda is on the board of, has limits to how long directors can serve, and they are elected. Other organizations are self-appointed and they have no end. It depends. Sometimes that can mean you have a board.
Or it can have an end, right? So you could have a fixed term on a self-appointed as well.
Thank you for clarifying that. You definitely can. And some of them do and some of them don't. And some of them that are self-appointed, so there are downsides to both. So elected models, often directors are going out just as they're becoming competent. Like they know they finally understand what's going on with the organization, and they finally have a plan, but now they're rolled off the board. And it depends on what the length of the term is. And some, and on the upside, they're very responsive to direct to their constituency, because they know they either have to be reelected or they're going to have a limit. Anyway, on the other hand, appointed boards can be a problem, because you have people who are there for so long that they lose touch with the community and they lose touch with what they're trying to accomplish. I've had many experiences with self-appointed boards where it's been lovely, because there's a lot of institutional knowledge and history. And it really just depends on how mission focused the organization is and how much they are able to engage their directors, that they stay engaged.
So just one thing, sorry, when you have that, it's interesting. I've been on both kinds of boards now that I've been on the OSI one where I was elected, as you say. What's the difference in terms of directors? So you have a statutory appointment, you sign up as a board director, that can be different in different states. But if you're elected, is there another layer of responsibility to the people that have elected you?
I mean, it's a classic politician's responsibility, right? Which is that if folks don't like you, they'll not vote for you next time. And that's most, I mean, there are recalls, but those are rare in different jurisdictions around the world, right? Usually politicians serve their term, and the responsiveness is that no one will get reelected or elected to another position if they do something that is not in the interest of their constituency. And I think that's generally the accountability. All directors, at least under general US various laws, have a duty of care and a duty of loyalty to their organization. And I know elsewhere around the world, there are similar duties that are attached to directors.
It's interesting. Yeah. A lot of it's to shareholders, and it's
right,
a complex.
But there are no shareholders in the nonprofit foundation model.
Whereas we actually, you know, delve into this quite happily, but within Open UK, because we're a company limited by guarantee, we have shareholders, and our board directors are also a shareholder, but we have no choice but to be down that structure. And just managing that is a different ball game. It's frustrating that we don't have the foundational structures.
There was a real trend in the United States to go towards companies that had like a beneficial model. And so there were shareholders, but the idea was to use the corporate model, the for-profit model. That's fallen out of favor largely because it doesn't tend to work out the way that people hope. I mean, when people collaborate together, there is often corruption. There is often politicking. I've been so dismayed to hear, to see in community after community, problematic situations happen. And what I've seen is that no organizational form is perfect. They all have their problems.
I agree with that.
But I feel a lot more comfortable participating in charitable style organizations, because the mission is what you ultimately will hold up to hold people's feet to the fire to make sure they're doing the right thing.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. We just don't have that luxury in the UK, unfortunately.
Yeah. There are a couple of different models in the UK, but none of them work completely like
and
the US
And we can't be
ones.
Charities. We don't fit the charitable structure in the UK, are they? Yeah.
Well, Karen, thank you for stopping by and chatting with us. Amanda, thank you for editing the book. We appreciate the efforts there. Everybody who has gotten a copy of the book, I am not one of them because she didn't decide. She didn't
Do you want a copy?
Classic.
Yeah. No. She didn't decide to give me one. But I am not one who has a copy of the book. That's okay.
Did you not stand in line with everybody else yesterday?
I just took the pictures for you.
Oh, I should say here clearly that we authors have not read the other. We were not able to read the other.
Really?
Vehemently disagree with some of the things that are included in this book. But because I wrote the foundation chapter, you should know that I agree with everything in the foundation chapter.
wait a minute. Maybe we should get back together in another week or so after you've read it, where you can tell us the things you disagree with.
I only skimmed through it quickly and like the most, and there were a couple of things in there that I was like, interesting.
But that when you get 25
but
people together,
it's not 25 people. Noah, you're right on the number. There's a bunch of people who are not lawyers, and then there's a group of lawyers, and you will never get a group of lawyers to all agree.
You never get 25 people to agree.
Make them lawyers, and it's even worse.
Okay. Well, Karen, thank you for stopping by today. Thank you for chatting. Thank you for, you know, letting me host, Amanda.
Thank you, Matt.
We will continue this series, and we hope that you'll like, subscribe, follow us, share this with your friends, and go ahead and pick up a copy of the book. And if you get a chance, send me a copy too.
Oh, can I do a quick plug?
Oh, of course.
Which is check out what we do at Software Freedom Conservancy. It's sfconservancy.org. And especially check out the lawsuit we filed against Vizio, which is a consumer rights case that like really connects the dots between copyleft and how software affects people. And then also outreachy.org, which is our diversity initiative.
Awesome. Awesome. We will definitely check those out.
Thank you.
All right. Until next time, we'll see you later.